Good afternoon, and welcome back to the second hour of We the People Radio. We're actually airing live today, November 17th, 2019, just in case we replay this at a different time. You'll have some context for our discussion. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And who's our sponsor this hour, Bill Cundiff?
Well, our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. If you're looking for a John Deere tractor or John Deere turf equipment, go by and see them. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in beautiful Shasta Lake City. And they've got a big inventory of tractors, implements, mowers, zero turns, you name it. They've got it in stock. Go by and talk to them. Also, they're a Honda dealer. They have a full line of Honda generators in stock. So power goes out. Go by and see them. Or you can reach them on the phone at 226-9226 and online at papemachinery.com. So there you
and
go.
In the event of the impending power outage later on this week in Northern California, you might want to go give them a
Get a generator before you need a generator.
Might want to check their generator stock, which is usually good, but don't wait till the power goes out. And also don't wait to go to the grocery store till the power's out. Pretty much take care of all that early. Oh, and fill up your gas tank, because otherwise the city of Redding gets really crowded because they don't shut the power off and all of a sudden the gas stations are overwhelmed.
Yeah. Californians have to be retrained now. We have a brand new program.
Got to do a survival and preparedness seminars out here. I got to tell you, we're not going to do well with that just based on history.
No.
Just based on events of the recent past.
Somebody needs to take care of me.
I had puppies die because my power went out. Oh, and I left them home in the dark and the cold while I went out to dinner. Huh. Definitely you should call, say, an elected official maybe and complain about that.
Yeah. Because they could fix it.
Member of the House. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there you go. And so let me scroll back up here. Our guest is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. We love having him on the show because he's full of information. And this is obviously a topic near and dear to his heart. He's written several articles, and I have trouble posting them a little bit, but I've got them on the site now. One was Pelosi's Illegitimate Impeachment Push and Our Vanishing Republic, and that's on there. He put that up on Newsmax September 25th of 2019. And then I think the other one we're going to veer into a little bit later is Clueless Democrats Don't Realize NATO Can't Lose Turkey. And that one, that was super recent. Can I see the date? Yes, October 16th. So those are all very current, very very pressing topics. But right before we went on the break, we were talking about the Inspector General's report that we've been hearing about for an eon. And I really think that most people hear Inspector General and they think there is only one for the entire federal government. And I'm not sure that
contraire.
And I don't think they realize, I don't think people really realize when those reports come out that it doesn't come out directly from him to the public, how it goes back through the agencies. So, Dr. Pry, maybe you could shed some light on how all that goes together so that we can all be smarter.
Sure. Well, let me say that Horowitz, I think if the report, if his Inspector General report, delivers what we're being told it will deliver, including recommended indictments, that will make Horowitz a very rare bird indeed, because he's not a Trump appointee. He's a holdover from the Obama administration. So there will have been one honest man, you know, who got through the Obama administration. And what, moreover, even rarer, you know, an honest man who's an inspector general.
Right.
You know, because the inspector general statute was passed during the Reagan administration. And it's one of the few times that I ever agreed with with the Democrats, with the liberal Democrats. The idea was instituted by, introduced by a Carl Levin, who was a very liberal Democrat senator. And his idea was that the inspector general, there would be an inspector general for every major department and agency of the U.S. government. So the Department of Defense would have an inspector general. The intelligence CIA would have an inspector general. You know, the Justice Department would have an inspector general. There'd be an FBI inspector general. Every major department and agency of the U.S. government would have an inspector general assigned to it to oversee it.
Now, are they independent of that agency?
Independent.
Okay.
And the office of the inspector general is supposed to be independent of that department or agency. Okay? You know, but Wallstetter, who was the... Weinberger, who was the Secretary of Defense at the time, opposed that for the Department of Defense, saw it as a, and probably legitimately, you know, because, you know, he suspected that this was a liberal attempt to try to penetrate and undermine Reagan administration defense policy, and it probably was, let's face it, okay? And so he insisted that the Inspector General be incorporated so it would belong to the Department of Defense and it would be funded through the Department of Defense. Or if it was on the FBI, it wouldn't be independent of the FBI, but integral, organic part of the FBI, paid for, administered by the FBI. And tactically, you know, that was a good idea to protect the Reagan administration policy from, you know, from Democrats, from, you know, who were probably created the Inspector General for the purpose of undermining Reagan administration policy. But strategically, taking the long view, it was, I think it was bad for the office, for the purpose of the Inspector General, and defeated the purpose of what the Inspector General is supposed to do.
Absolutely.
Because we've had the case of regulatory capture happen.
Mm-hmm.
So the Inspector Generals who belong to these various department agencies identify with them and have great loyalty to them. And I have had personal experience with this myself. And in fact, when I worked at the CIA, okay, I was very concerned with the left. There was even then, okay, it was the end toward the end of the Reagan administration. The left-leaning attitude of the that affected intelligence analysis and tended to bury or ignore data intelligence, which contradicted the narrative that the intelligence community was putting out, which was geared toward undermining the president's policy. And to cite just one example of that, I mean a really obvious example, because obviously I can't talk about classified intelligence, all right, but I thought it was appalling that, you know, when President Reagan was advancing the Strategic Defense Initiative, which was a brilliant idea, a way of rendering nuclear missiles obsolete, a way of giving the United States the upper hand in the Cold War, and indeed, even though we never deployed SDI, the threat of SDI, the Soviets themselves, many high-ranking Soviet officials and generals, have admitted that the mere threat of the coming on of the SDI, that defeated them in the Cold War. You know, looking down the road, they knew we were so technologically ahead of them in this area that they would not be able to compete, and that they had felt that had lost the Cold War at that point. So it was a brilliant idea, but not thought so by the particular office in which I worked at the CIA, because many analysts were clipping out cartoons that belittled President Reagan and the SDI program and plastered them all over their doors and their walls. And I thought that this was intellectually unhealthy, you know?
Just a little.
To say the least. And so I went to the Inspector General, not just over that, but there were other more important issues as well that I brought to the Inspector General's attention. And it wasn't acted upon. And I found out years later, after I left the agency, and I was working with, I was on the House Armed Services Committee then, and I was assigned to Congressman Weldon, who was the, you know, vice chairman, the second, he was the vice chairman of the House Armed Services Committee that writes the defense budget and writes the, which, from which the intelligence budget is also paid. And Weldon was a fierce critic of the intelligence community, not an unreasonable critic by any means. I agreed with Kurt, you know, on a lot of the cover-ups that they were engaged in and acts of underestimating threats they were engaged in. Well, we were invited to meet with the director of Central Intelligence at the time, the CIA director at the time, John Deutsch, who glad-handed us and, you know, invited. Basically, we were having a little gathering. They were trying to butter Kurt up and butter me up as part of his staff. And there was a woman there who had been the inspector general, who I had talked to, had brought, and she came up to me, and she couldn't resist. She couldn't refrain. She was still so angry. I didn't know it at the time. I had the impression that she was listening to me fairly and was actually going to take action on what I said. But she said, you know, I can't believe, you know, after all the agency did for you, that you came to me with that complaint, you know. And I told her that I couldn't believe that she had that attitude, because it was my impression that the inspector general was supposed to welcome criticisms so that we would evade, well, another Pearl Harbor, for example, right, in the nuclear missile age, and that it was their job to hear things like this, and so that the agency would not destroy its reputation by making catastrophic mistakes. And that little encounter taught me that these inspector generals are flypaper. For the most part, they're flypaper. You know, what they're really intended to do is weed out dissidents who don't support the company. That's
which,
right.
Which leads us right into how they do their report and, quote, whistleblowers. We've got to take a really quick break. We're going to come back. There's a lot to unpack in that whole thing, and we're not going to do it in 2 minutes, but that's how long we're going to celebrate capitalism. So we'll be right back after our little celebration of capitalism. You're listening to We the People. Reason I chose that song, because at the end of the day, the inspector general's report winds up going to the agency that they are
investigating,
scrutinizing.
Right.
Then they work together on the report. Then the report's issued. So you don't see never see the raw data, and I don't think the public realizes. Like a great example of one that I actually worked on was with the VA down in Oakland. And I was getting phone calls from whistleblowers I was working with inside the VA. They were actual whistleblowers who actually saw real things and didn't file whistleblower protection, because that just means they get fired. So they said, oh, my God, they found crack pipes in the bathroom today. And I'm like, whoa, that's not going to be good. Oh, I'm sorry. Was that in the report?
No, they worked it out.
Yeah, they worked it out. That didn't show up in there.
They just didn't realize they weren't supposed to bring
all the people who did bad
things.
Oh, none of that was in there. They found it all, but no one was held accountable, and the bottom line on the report was the same as every other inspector general report for the VA, which is they need more training, more supervision, and probably more money.
Exactly.
So is that the reason?
I don't think people realize there's collaboration, and
well,
this isn't some big...
But there's never any accountability that way. I mean, the people that do these egregious things are still there.
That's what we call it, government.
Oh, that's right. And not only are they still there, but they get promoted.
Right,
and then there's that.
You know, a sterling example of this is the 9/11 disaster. You know, killed 3,000 Americans, dead. You know, one of the biggest intelligence failures in history, and nobody gets fired. not only does nobody get fired, but the people most responsible for it in the intelligence community get promoted. And, you know, it'll really be now, people are, the hopes are being built up very high that the Horowitz report's going to rescue us.
Mm-hmm.
That just says so much about how weak the Republicans are in defending our constitutional republic, that the fate of our constitutional republic depends on Obama holdover inspector general doing the right thing again.
Right.
Can you imagine the pressure on that guy? You know, we've just talked about this, and he's got to, as Aaron pointed out, he's got to coordinate his report. I'm hoping that this guy will continue to be courageous and tell the truth. Whatever that report says, though, you can be sure that it's much worse than whatever that report says.
Oh, absolutely.
Right, because they take out all the real smoking gun high
points.
Well,
and maybe part of the saving grace of this report will be that a lot of the people that are no longer there will be in the report, and so that it's not like you're going to have to fire somebody for wrongdoing because they're already gone.
Well, Brennan and people like that are gone at the very top level, all right? But for every Brennan, there's 10 or 100 people who he elevated, who bored their way into the system, into the bureaucracy, and they're still there. And these people are, going to do everything they can to soften that report, to take the hard edges off the report. Now, I keep hearing from, from Lou Dobbs and other Fox News shows and people who appear to have access are promising us that the report is going to be a good report and that indictments will come or be recommended. And I pray God that is true. However good it is, it's still not going to be telling the whole truth.
No.
You know, in fact, most of the truth is probably going to be still covered up, and only the most egregious things will be disclosed. If that happens, we might all get a big surprise, and maybe the bad guys will succeed in turning Horowitz, and it won't be nearly as condemnatory as we're all hoping, and honest as we're all hoping. I find it, very disappointing, to say the least, and very suspicious that the report, the much-promised report, that will soon be published. How long have we been hearing? Okay,
yeah.
It's coming out in the last year of the administration. At a time when there's going to be a presidential election. We're going to be swinging into presidential politics, it'll be a time period when it will be hardest to act upon. If it does come out as a decent report and makes these recommendations, it's always hard during the last year of an administration when you're trying to run for re-election to act on those recommendations. It gives a real good chance for the bad guys to get away scot-free, especially if the president doesn't win re-election.
And it
certainly will give them an incentive. This is what I was trying to get to. If the Horowitz report is good and tells the truth and recommends indictments against guys like Brennan, what will they do? Are they going to stand by and just let that happen?
Nope.
The mainstream media is always worried about a coup d'etat from the right, okay?
Yeah.
We already had an attempted coup d'etat from the left. If these guys have to face jail time, they are, former CIA directors, former FBI directors. They have connections that go deep into the system, and allies deep into the system that could be mobilized and create a nightmare scenario.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is the stuff you make scary movies out of.
Talked about a couple of my articles. It was in the first article I wrote on this. Now, I'm trying to remember the title of it myself. 7 Days in May for Real. It was called 7 Days in May for Real. I published that a few years ago. It was when the story broke about about the FBI counterintelligence investigation, so-called counterintelligence investigation, that was aimed at President Trump. I tried to point out that, there had been a movie made back, was it the 60s? I think it was the 60s, called 7 Days in May.
Oh, yeah.
That postulated a coup against a liberal American president who, over a foreign policy issue, who wanted a nuclear disarmament treaty with the Soviet Union and an American general, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, decided to orchestrate a coup d'etat to save the country from this idiotic foreign policy that the liberal American president wanted to perform. And I just thought it incredibly, and this was written with a serious purpose. It wasn't just by the Hollywood movie was written and produced. And Kirk Douglas had been a socialist, and he was a left-wing activist. He was one of the heroes in this thing. They actually had real people in mind. They thought that Ernest LeMay, who had been the commander of the Strategic Air Command at the time, that he was capable of mounting a coup against President Kennedy. And that's what 7 Days in May was supposed to have been, what was been about, even though it might have been made after the Kennedy administration. At the time it was conceived and the screenplay written, that's the scenario they had in mind. So how ironic, decades later, and after Nixon and everything, I mean, we periodically hear from the left all the time about the threat that the right supposedly poses to our constitutional republic.
Oh, yeah.
But when it comes right down to it, they're the ones. They're the ones, that are threatening our constitutional republic, have already destroyed it, just by mounting this illegal and unconstitutional impeachment inquiry for political purposes. They've shredded the Constitution by what they're doing right now every day on TV.
Well, and
the question is, can we get our constitutional republic back?
Right.
Well, also, you got to look at future presidents are going to look at what's going on with the intelligence community today, and do they dare go against them in the future? I mean, you talk about intimidating. Look at what they're capable of doing. I think, they want to talk about intimidating a witness and blah, blah, blah. I think the intelligence community is very intimidating at this point to any future president that wants to go against their wishes.
Sure. The whole apparatus of the state, in addition to the intelligence community, you take something like the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we already played footsie with
happened.
Them.
There's never, and this is another thing where I damn the Republicans for failing in their job. Here we've had President Trump for 3 years, and the Democrats got away, with the IRS scandal, where they basically used the powers of the IRS to destroy hundreds of conservative nonprofits.
Mm-hmm.
President Obama might not have gotten that second term, if the IRS hadn't done that, because that's what conservatives, the left had been using the 501c3 provision in the IRS code to establish nonprofits that were basically activist groups for
right.
left-wing political purposes, and doing that for decades successfully. Okay,
sure. And look at how successful
the
environmental groups are.
A long time to figure out. Gee, we could be doing that too. And then when we tried to do it, the Obama administration wouldn't let it happen, and they got away with it.
Yeah, I know our group here in Reading kind of had our legs cut out from under us, but. They continued to fight it. It was just, again, there seems to be no equal application of justice under the system. We have to take a really
right.
quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and I cannot believe we have already blown through most of the show. Unbelievable. Great information today. You can find it all at wethepeopleradio.us.
You have to learn to pace yourself. You're just like everybody else. Pressure. You've only had to run so far, so good.
should always find you gotta saddle up your boys, you gotta draw a hard line.
When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune, and we'll all meet back at the local saloon.
We'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.
When we get our secret hardcore right wing enclave, that's going to be our theme song.
Yeah,
we're going to put it in like Wyoming or somewhere where no one will think to look for us. and we're gonna celebrate truth and justice and I don't know, go to Galt's Gulch, I guess.
Yeah,
I always loved that song.
I do too.
I wonder if we could talk about Turkey before we lose all of our time.
Yeah, we are. We're going to run out of time.
Okay. but actually, it does fit in to the larger theme of what we're talking about how the president is responsible for setting our foreign policy. And this is just another example, an actually bigger and more important example than Ukraine, of the struggle for who's in charge of our government and our policies. Is it the deep state or is it the president of the United States? Because there's much at stake here in President, and I call it, say, Turkey, but it's basically President Trump's Syria policy. And I wrote an article that was published much more recently. I think it was on November 5th. I had to actually publish it in Canada by the McKenzie Institute because I couldn't get it published, even in conservative journals here in the United States, because it supported President Trump on his Syrian policy. And even many conservatives are attacking President Trump for withdrawing those 1,000 troops from Syria. And also, since President Trump just recently met with Erdogan,
yeah.
Yeah, it's perhaps appropriate that we should say something, you know, about this issue. And the title of my article was American Empire or America First? ? And basically talks about what I call the Trump Doctrine. And President Trump himself has not declared a foreign policy doctrine, but there is one that he ran on. And in effect, what I think it amounts to is, you know, President Trump, contrary to his critics, is not an isolationist. He's not trying to go back. When he says America First, he's not talking about, you know, the 1930s and 1940s American firsters who wanted America to go into an isolationist crouch and not get involved anywhere in the world. President Trump does want to maintain our alliance relationships, but they've got to be true alliances where our alliance partners carry their fair share of the defense burden, so that it really isn't an imperial system where America is carrying nearly 100% of the costs and sacrifices to defend so-called alliances. You know, that's not an alliance system. That's an imperial system where we have where America has unwillingly, you know, become the owner of an enormous empire. You know, we have over 100 American troops are in over 150 countries worldwide, mostly engaged in continuing the forever war against terrorism. So part of the America First policy is to make sure our allies carry their fair share, and also to end the endless forever war on terrorism and shift it really to away from where it has, instead of the United States having to carry that. That's an example of the kind of thing that involves localized conflicts or regional conflicts that our allies should be engaged in. And it shouldn't necessarily be done with military force. It's really, intelligence agencies like the CIA are far better suited for that. You know, the Department of Defense tends to use these sledgehammer tactics, you know, the launching a cruise missile into wedding parties, that tends to, so they can get a terrorist leader, but then they kill the bride, and it tends to create more terrorists than it kills. You know, you need to be targeted, you know, very limited. Britain and Russia are good examples. In the 19th century, they managed to protect their interests and advance their interests in the Middle East and Central Asia with just a handful of area specialists who had money to spread around, who had guns to spread around, who knew the languages and knew the tribes, and got them to do the biddings of their particular governments. If they did nothing else, they could stir up trouble and have them picnicking on each other instead of being a threat to British and Russian interests. And that's up until, you know, the global war on terrorism. That's how we were conducting the policy before 9/11. And had Bill Clinton not been a coward and done his job, we wouldn't have had a 9/11 and had a global war on terrorism. It's right in the 9/11 Commission reports, you know, where you can read that the agency gave Bill Clinton, you know, three opportunities to take out, to liquidate Osama bin Laden. And he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't pull the trigger on any of them. And 3,000 Americans paid the price for that. But coming back, so that's another part of the Trump doctrine, you know, having, marshaling our forces and being smarter in the use of our forces so that instead of having the Pentagon chiefly responsible for conducting something like a global war on terrorism, that's done by our allies and it's done by their intelligence services in cooperation with our intelligence services, so that our military, with our limited economic resources, because America, you know, even though we're still the wealthiest nation in the world, the percentage of wealth that we control is nothing like it was in the aftermath of World War II, you know, when we controlled something like 50% of world gross domestic product. You know, now we control a much smaller percentage of the pie. And so we can't do everything. The Pentagon always wants to do everything. What we need to do is the big job, which is play the balance of power politics and have conventional and nuclear forces that are sufficiently strong so that we can deter Russia or China or North Korea or Iran from starting a World War III, or if they do start it, that we can win it. We can't do everything and do that. That's the biggest, most important job for the United States, and it's what we should be doing. Afghanistan alone was costing us $50 billion a year, you know? And as I said, we're in 150 nations. So this thing has been a real impediment to serving this role, and this is, I call it the Trump Doctrine, but really, that was basically what the United States was doing throughout most of the Cold War until we got involved in the global war on terrorism. So it's a kind of ironic that what President Trump is trying to do is go back to the policies of Eisenhower and Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon, minus the Vietnam War, okay? But we have a new business-as-usual thing that we've been doing, which is the global war on terrorism. And that's why the establishment doesn't want them to pull 1,000 troops out of Turkey. And I thought this was a good test. This was an interesting test for President Trump to begin his policy of withdrawing American troops from places that they don't belong anymore so that we can husband our forces for the big one, to deter the big one or win the big one if it comes along. 1,000 troops, just 1,000 troops. And their mission had already been accomplished. You know, we basically destroyed ISIS, destroyed the caliphate. There was mopping up to do, but that could be done by Turk and the Syrians and the Russians. And those troops were at great risk. You know, 1,000 troops surrounded by hundreds of thousands of hostile forces, Russian, Syrian, and Iranian, and terrorist hostile forces. It was a catastrophe waiting to happen. But the Department of Defense and the State Department were adamantly opposed. His own Secretary of Defense, opposed, Mad Dog Mattis opposed us pulling those troops out of Syria, you know. So this, here again, you've got a case of the permanent bureaucracy, including Trump's own appointees, you know, opposing the new policy that the United States, that President Trump wanted us to pursue. And it's a smart policy. It's a policy the United States should be pursuing. And in part and parcel of this attempt to undermine the Trump policy was romanticizing the Kurds. How can we abandon the Kurds? You know, yeah. The Kurds did so much to take out ISIS. We owe the Kurds so much. Well, that's considered absolutely backwards. You know, the Kurds weren't doing us any favors. ISIS was their mortal enemy. They had to fight ISIS, or ISIS was going to destroy them. We're the ones that saved the Kurds in the first place by helping them, supporting them in the war against ISIS. And we had temporary interests in common with the Kurds. But we don't have the kind of long-term interests in common with the Kurds that we do with Turkey. Basically, you've actually had people on the left and the right in Washington calling for expelling Turkey from NATO and in favor of the Kurds. And this is an example, I mean, again, strange situation, where Trump is accused of disrupting business as usual, you know, in his Syrian policy. But what he's really doing is remembering older and wiser statesmen's policies toward that region of the world and trying to reinstate those policies, because Turkey is far more important to long-term U.S. national security interests than the Kurds. You know, basically, the NATO alliance...
I can hear the Democrats screaming, blasphemer!
Yes, right. I mean, the NATO alliance is indefensible without Turkey. You know, not only is Turkey, after the United States, the strongest military member of NATO, it has more tanks, it has more planes, more troops than any other member of NATO, including Britain and France and Germany. So it's the strongest military member of NATO. It's geographically, it's got this incredibly important geographic location where it's close to the Middle East, you know, right next door to Syria, near Lebanon and Israel, this vitally important crossroads of the world that since biblical times has decided the fate of empires, okay? And it controls the Marmara Sea and the Dardanelles and the Bosporus so that it can keep the powerful Russian Black Sea fleet bottled up in the Black Sea. It also is an unsinkable aircraft carrier. It's got 100 air bases, airports that could be used to support air operations over the Balkans, over the Black Sea, over the Middle East. Now, we're in a tug of
that,
war.
Hold that thought. We better take a quick break because we're headed for the top of the hour and want to give you enough time to sum up the entire world policy and the impeachment in the last few minutes. No pressure.
I will endeavor to do so.
Oh, okay, cool. You'll be right back. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
It's a party in the CIA. Need a country to stabilize. Look no further, we're your guide. We're your guide. We've got snazzy suits and ties. Suits and ties. And a better get in the van, pearls will get blown away. Staging a coup like it, brainwashing moles like it. We only torture the folks we don't like. You're probably gonna be okay.
You're gonna be okay.
Yeah. It's a party in the CIA. Yeah. It's a party in the CIA.
Money they spend upon the moon. Well, I'm sure they make it right. I hope they never sleep at night. They better make some changes and do it soon. Take it.
Well said. So, you know, heading into this next week, do you think any of this is going to have anything to do with policy and all that, or is this just going to be another dog show with a bunch of people trying to make the president look like a bad guy and no substance?
Oh, you've already lost interest in Turkey? I guess that was...
No, I just wondered
not as
because...
interesting as I hope your audience would find it.
No,
let me wrap
it
up the
is,
Turkey
but,
thing, okay?
But Turkey,
and then I'll answer that question.
Yeah, because Turkey
the
is the point.
The bottom line is you know, we are in a tug of war with Russia over Turkey.
Right.
Russia might be able to flip Turkey and pull them into their orbit. If that happens, NATO is indefensible because the Russian Black Sea fleet can get out into the Mediterranean, and then Turkey becomes an unsinkable aircraft carrier for Russia.
For Russia.
Yeah.
And a Turkey hostile to us. And if you just think about where Turkey's located relative to the Mediterranean Sea, I mean, the whole southern flank of NATO is suddenly ripped wide open. And you cannot defend NATO under those circumstances. So we cannot afford to lose Turkey. And we may well lose Turkey. You know,
well,
didn't
Russia just supply them with a bunch of missiles?
Pardon me? Yeah, Russia is supplying them with air defense missiles. That's
right.
One of the points that the deep state doesn't want us to sell F-35s to Turkey if they're going to buy Russian missiles.
Right.
And so, you know, if we cancel the F-35 sales, that further brings Russia Turkey into Russia's orbit. And and Erdogan, he's not a nice guy. He's an Islamist. He's an authoritarian personality. And it was predicted decades ago by an excellent book, Clash of Civilizations, that Turkey would rediscover its Islamist roots and eventually leave NATO. And it might be happening now, and it might be historically inevitable. But we shouldn't be pushing them out of NATO and into Russia's arms. We should be doing everything we can to try to keep them in NATO. Otherwise, it would be a catastrophe for us. And President Trump seems to be the only one in Washington who understands that. These deep state guys who have forgotten the Cold War, but they remember the global war on terrorism and therefore are, have a love affair with the Kurds, they're the ones who are actually wanting us to stick with yesterday's business, which was the global war on terrorism, whereas tomorrow's business is the new Cold War with Russia and with China, but with Russia, Turkey matters immensely. So I'll conclude my remarks on that. And that's why, but it's just an example of one of the most important foreign policy differences between President Trump and the deep state that's going on right now, where, again, President Trump is, well, not only is he right, but even if he was wrong, his policy is the one that should be followed because he's the president. Now, to answer your questions, what do I anticipate in terms of the future of the impeachment inquiry? I think it's going to be more of the dog and pony show.
Okay.
Except they gave it their best shot. Those witnesses, I understand that they had, the State Department people were their best, and they gave it their best shot. So it's actually going to be the kinds of witnesses they bring on, unless Schiff is smart enough to hold back some kind of a huge surprise that nobody's anticipated. I think they're going to be less and less impressive witnesses with even less relevant testimony to provide.
Because all this information, I guess I wasn't I wasn't trying to derail you from Turkey. What I was actually wondering is, do you think anybody in this process is ever going to bring up any of that? Because that's all part of it, and that's why some of these decisions were made. Conditional aid and that sort of thing. I just don't see any of that being brought forward. They're still telling the public that they're not allowed to do that, that the career bureaucrats are the ones who have all the knowledge, make all the decisions, and should be calling all the shots.
Well, Representative Jordan, for example, a number of the...
He's been doing a pretty good job.
They've been doing an excellent job pointing out that it's the president's job to set foreign policy, and they've made that point over and over again in the context of Ukraine. I have to again fault the Republicans here for the way they decided to handle this. In one of the articles that you cited, Our Vanishing Republic, I made a number of recommendations of what the Republicans should do. And one of the things I think that they should do was not participate, not even participate, because by their mere presence, even though they're taking a role of defending President Trump, it lends legitimacy to a process that's unconstitutional and illegal. The charges, alleged, put quotes around that of charges, what they're trying to call charges, the idea that the president is trying to use foreign aid money to influence Ukrainian policy, there's nothing illegal about that.
No, that's actually what he's supposed to be doing.
Every president does it. The Republicans should be so opposed to the idea of bringing an impeachment inquiry that they should refuse to participate in it, to end an air of legitimacy to it. And they should be holding press conferences every day saying, you know, this is an example of the Democrats behaving like a totalitarian party, that it's all a sham, it's all a political thing. They should be holding their own hearings. They should be withholding recognition from Nancy Pelosi and from Schiff as legitimate chairman, because they've shredded the Constitution in a very obvious way through this impeachment, and they've given up the right to be regarded legitimately as leaders of the House on the Democrat side. And the Republicans could and should be holding their own hearings on this, where they send out subpoenas, you know, to bring in Biden and his son and Hillary and do embarrassing things to the Democrats. They could even pass bills from the Republican caucus and send them to the Senate. Now, of course, all of this too is just political theater. But that's what the Democrats are doing too. It's political theater for political purpose, and the Republicans need to fight fire with fire. So I think that they're not fighting back hard enough or smart enough, even though they are making smart points in the hearings and on Fox News and the rest. The simple fact that they're there every day lends legitimacy to proceedings which are not legitimate.
Well, I think by by not being there, I think wouldn't it be even more damaging? I mean, you kind of have to be there, or else you're conspicuously.
Do you think the public would get it?
I think that they would. If the Republicans held press conferences to explain why they're not there,
that's true.
Impeachment is supposed to be a bipartisan process, you know. And I think that their absence would speak volumes. It would speak volumes to the people that this was purely a Democrat thing, not a Republican thing. And I know the argument that you just made, that, well, isn't that abandoning the floor to them and giving them, and that's a legitimate argument, and that's basically the winning argument. That's why the Republicans are there, because they don't want to just give Adam Schiff free rein.
Yeah,
but I would argue that on balance, it does more damage to our case to lend legitimacy to this illegitimate, unconstitutional process by participating in it.
That's a cool idea. I like that. I hope people will go on and read your articles. We are out of time, but I've linked all sorts of good stuff for you during the show, so you can find that at wethepeopleradio.us. We're here on November 17th, 2019, with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pryde. Thank you so much.
And thank you for having me.
Catch everyone again next week.